Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air.
Hello, everybody. We are starting a new Real World Radio show, this time to speak about what was the seventh round of negotiations on the binding treaty on transnational corporations and human rights, which took place from October the 25th to October the 29th in Geneva, where the Human Rights Council of the United Nations follow its negotiations, and where this particular group of work, which follows these negotiations on the binding treaty and transnational corporations, is having its own negotiations every year. We have with us today Brit Brennan from the Transnational Institute, also Jill McArdle, she's from Friends of the Earth Europe, Erika Mendes, who is from JA, Justicia Ambiental, Friends of the Earth Mozambique, and also representing Friends of the Earth Africa. And we also have here with us Andresa Suarez from OMAH, which is the Human Rights and Business Center. You are all super welcome, and I really appreciate you took the time to be in this show today. And I would like to start with you, Jill, if it's possible, to have from you an overall evaluation of this new round of negotiations, of this process that started in 2015 after the approval of this process the year before on 2014. So we have had now already seven rounds of negotiations, and I would like to particularly focus on this last one. You all are representatives of the global campaign to dismantle corporate power and end the impunity of the transnational corporations. And then I would like to know, Jill, what do you evaluate, what do you assess from this last round of negotiations in Geneva? Thank you very much, Jill.
Thank you, Jose. I'm really glad to be here. Yes, I was there in Geneva at the end of October. It was an exciting year because there was actual negotiations on the text, which was a first. I think that really says that the process is moving forward. There were also some worrying moves. The US showed up and came into the room and had some very negative proposals that would have a very bad impact on the process, which was not great. But maybe others can add more on that. And I'll tell you a bit more about the role of the EU and what they did in the room, as this is what we work on here in Brussels. The EU was there, and it has been every year for the past 7 years, and a few member states in the room, even though they don't have what we call a mandate to be there. This means that the EU, because it's a block of states, would need to get together before the session and go through their own legal process to agree what their position is, and then to agree to form a negotiating team that they would send in. And because they've never done that, the EU delegation that is in there can't actually speak formally for the EU. And this is a situation that's been going on for a long time. And what they do at the beginning of the session is they usually make an opening statement, and then they make maybe some comments throughout the session. This year, it was a bit more ridiculous to take this approach because the other states were actually negotiating on the text. The EU, in its opening statement, was very much following the lines of what it says every year, which is that the process isn't aligned enough with the UNGPs and that it's too prescriptive. These are things we've heard again and again. They're still not saying more about what they mean by not aligned with the UNGPs. Certainly if this means that they want to empty the treaty of its really strong content and just have a text that restates the UNGPs, this is completely unacceptable. There was a proposal from the US last week, 2 weeks ago, that would change the direction of the treaty and really gut the treaty of its good content. And they also talked about more alignment with the UNGPs. So it's quite a worrying thing to hear from the EU as well. We definitely think the treaty needs to go further and make actual progress in international law and make up for the weaknesses that exist in the current standards instead of just restating these standards. The EU did make some mildly positive contributions, I say mildly, because they were on things that were quite easy for them to make interventions on, like defense of human rights defenders, the inclusion of the environment and gender. These are areas where the EU has policies, so it feels a bit more confident to talk about. But these were not recorded in the session because, as I said, the EU has no mandate to engage in the negotiations. So it was left to some EU member states, for example, France, to intervene and say, well, can we include what the EU has just said in the text, and France will back it up. So it's a bit of a frustrating situation now for the EU to be there and have an ongoing concrete negotiation, have nothing that they say actually be recorded. Especially ridiculous because the EU has its own law coming, which is going to be on human rights due diligence. And we are also really focused on that in the EU because we want to make sure that they have a strong and effective EU law and that they then get a mandate for the treaty negotiation and defend the ambitious treaty and not water down the treaty. But the EU has a pretty bad track record on being easily captured by corporations. We also do work here on corporate capture, and there is a lot of evidence that policies can be undermined here by business lobbies. We did some research this year on the lobby around the new coming EU due diligence law, exposing some of the lobbying around that, and that often these businesses who say they're in favor of new binding rules on corporate accountability, actually what they really want is to get involved and to make sure that the law has no teeth and is not effective. So because of that, it was a bit unsurprising, but very frustrating and completely unacceptable that at the end of the treaty session, the EU proposed to include businesses in the stakeholders that would be consulted in the intersessional period in a process that will involve member states in a Friends of the Chair process. This civil society was very upset by, and we communicated that to the EU because these businesses, especially transnational corporations, are the human rights violators. They should not be allowed to write the rules. They have wide privileges and rights in investment agreements already, and we need tough rules to counter that power and privilege, and we don't need more tools that just give businesses incentives instead of punishing them for the violations.
Thank you very much, Jill. So we are starting with the most problematic issues which arose during this seventh round of negotiations, and you were very good, Jill, explaining the role played by the EU. I would like to ask you, Breid, you have been involved in this process from the very beginning, and you are based in Europe. What can you tell us about the role played by the EU and the European countries from the very beginning? I mean, is it something different today if you compare what we have been seeing in the last years of the negotiations, which started in 2015, as I said before?
Well, Jose, it's good to review, actually. I think all of us came to Geneva, actually, with a lot of trepidation. I mean, there was a fog of 2 years of Zoom and exchanges online, and a very, a feeling that we really needed to grasp the treaty back in our sort of rhythm of engagement. And I think I feel that really happened also in the context of the current conjuncture. I mean, we're really in the middle of probably, you know, one of the most intense periods of interlocking crisis. And what's remarkable at one level is that the representation of the geopolitics and the geopolitical forces on the floor was very, very evident. I mean, this is one of the few spaces, I mean, it didn't even happen at COP, where besides the northern powerhouses like the US and Europe, you had also China and Russia and, of course, the so-called emerging economies. But, I mean, Brazil was there, South Africa was there. So I think in one way it is a real victory for the campaign that civil society has been launching, no? That despite the kind of, this intervening period of COVID and people forced to just only engage even governments online, we were really able to kind of see that the treaty does matter. And we've, of course, always known, and we bring the message from the beginning that the treaty matters for the most especially for the affected communities. This has been our really constant message. It was also very good that this time, even though we had smaller delegations, the message of the affected communities well sort of resonating and aligned with the crisis we are in and the role of corporations, we were really able to bring this across. There was a very dynamic presence of our delegations, no, with the global campaign, also in cooperation with Treaty Alliance and with the Feminists for a Binding Treaty, no. So I would say that looking over the long roadmap that we have followed, we'll say when the UNGPs were first put on the table, well, first of all, when the campaign was launched in 2012 in Rio, yeah, certainly the demand for binding regulations was the strongest sort of outcome of the processes we'd had before that. And this is what was brought to Geneva, even on the day on which the UNGPs were signed. So I think this message is really what's making, yeah, the EU and, of course, the US, yeah, I think they are feeling the pressure of that demand, that no matter what you say about the UNGPs, it's still finally a gentleman's agreement among the polluters and violators of human rights. So I think we really managed to establish a new presence and an effective presence, which was also reflected in the way in which governments responded. And I would really like to say that, you know, the U.S. came back after an absence. They came immediately with, you know, you're on the wrong track. You should be doing the framework agreement. And only Ukraine, as far as I can recall, and the EU a bit mumbling on that, sort of supported that. There was very immediate pushback from the Philippines, from Indonesia, from Cameroon. I mean, this was really clear that there is a real commitment from some governments, and we know that, and we have to build on it to really push on this binding treaty.
Thank you very much, Breed. And I would like to come back to the topic of the negotiations being virtual and at the same time also in person, being present there in Geneva, because it was raised by the Global Campaign to Dismantle Corporate Power as a very difficult point, a concerning one, being that for many poor countries, it is super difficult to go to Geneva in a moment in which probably most of their populations haven't even taken the vaccines against COVID. And then also what has to do with the difficulties to connect to internet in some poor countries. So for the government representatives, it was also a challenge, but also, of course, for the civil society. It was a point that was very concerning, as I said, for the global campaign. So I would like to know your evaluation, Erica, now being from Mozambique. What do you assess about what really happened in that sense in the negotiations? And also, if you can share with us a bit more of what Breed said in terms of the countries which played a good role in these negotiations. I mean, we did mention before that the United States and the European Union were bad in terms of defending the process and the mandate of the 26-9 resolution. But also there were some governments that played a very good role. So please share with us something about that, Erica. Thank you.
Thank you, Jose. Yes, indeed, the participation of civil society and social movements and the affected people was one of the key challenges for this session because, myself, I attended the session virtually. I could not travel to Geneva. I haven't been vaccinated yet. But luckily, I was in the same time zone, which was not the case for many other groups and organizations who have been really following the process for many years and are in Latin America or in Asia. And the time zones are also an issue that undermine the participation. Amidst all of this, we have the ever-changing quarantine rules that make it really impossible to try to predict the kind of costs that we will have and to plan in advance. and many other constraints related to travel and even the economic impacts of the pandemic in our countries and in our organization. So it's been really challenging in the past 2 years. And we have highlighted this in our statements and also calling for the chair of the Intergovernmental Working Group to make a bigger effort to ensure that civil society's voices can be heard, but most importantly, are actually able to influence the direction of the negotiations. So it's been really challenging. But even amidst all these challenges, I think it was really important to note that this process has a very broad participation. We have many people participating in Geneva and also from all the regions virtually. And I think that was really felt across all the days of the session. So we had really good inputs coming from the different regions and also from the affected peoples themselves and popular lawyers and experts. And we also had some very good inputs from states, especially from the Global South. Because as Brid was saying, it's very evident. It is always evident, but I think this session was really too obvious to see the geopolitical alignments within the session and what were the proposals that were being brought by different countries in different groupings and what kind of interests they were defending. You have talked about the EU and the US proposals. And it was really interesting to note that most of the arguments being used by the EU or the USA trying to undermine this process are pretty much the same as the ones we keep hearing from corporate representatives and from organizations that represent the private sector, such as the International Chamber of Commerce or the International Organization of Employers. And they're basically constantly trying to weaken the bits of good content that we have in the draft. So any attempt to make a step forward in terms of regulating these big companies that are able to stay in impunity due to their complexity, to the power asymmetries and all of this, all of the elements that we can consider good in the draft are constantly being attacked by some of the global North powers and private sector representatives. They keep on reinforcing that voluntary guidelines are enough. It's just an issue of implementation. So they keep also pointing for the states, and especially the states in the Global South, that basically they are the problem and they need to improve the implementation of existing guidelines. On the other side, we could also see very good inputs from some of the states in the South. And coming from Africa, we've been paying a close attention to what has been the engagement from African states. And very consistently, we've been having some African states bringing some very good proposals to the table, especially in relation to the treaty needing to establish direct legal obligations for companies and not only for states, which really aims to bring tools to regulate these companies, even when states are not willing or not able to regulate the companies. There's also been some interesting debates around the participation of civil society and the importance of the participation of civil society, and civil society's contributions has been highlighted by several of these states. So it's been good to see that from the African region, we have some countries participating with good proposals, that we can see that they're not only participating in the session, but they're actually committing to this process in the longer term. And most of them discussing these issues with the capitals and with the ministries, like South Africa, Namibia. This year we had Cameroon with very good proposals, Egypt as well. So it's been good to see. Maybe the negative part I would highlight from the African region would be that we did not hear a group statement from the African region. Usually we expect that in every session and in the past, in all the face-to-face sessions that we had before, so the five first sessions, we always had a group statement from the African group that usually is presented by the chair of the group. That this year was Cameroon, but there was no group statement. So this is maybe the negative part of that. But in overall, we had some good inputs and we're glad to see some strong elements coming back to the text and trying to improve what we already have, which is a weak draft.
Thank you, Erica. And Reza, Erica was just saying that there were some elements that are again in the draft of this binding treaty, which are on the table again, and that were super important for the global campaign to dismantle corporate power, because as I said at the beginning, they were important in terms of respecting the mandate by the 26.9 resolution. One of them, according to what I understood from the global campaign, is, for example, the primacy that must have the human rights over, for example, the free trade agreements. But I would like to ask you, Andres, if you could explain us a bit more and what are exactly the points that are again on the text and are important for the global campaign. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Sure, Jose. So we had a lot of points that were really important for the global campaign reinserted in the text by countries like Palestine, Egypt, Cuba, Cameroon, mainly. And the first one is, like you already said, is the primacy of human rights that was inserted, proposed by Palestine in many articles. And it was really important to reinstate the primacy of human rights, and that this instrument is a human rights instrument. It should prevail over investment agreements and other type of treaties. So this was a big deal and was a big victory for us. Also, we had, like you said, to respect the resolution 26/9. We had a lot of countries advocating for the scope to remain on transnational corporations, which is something that we at the global campaign also defend, because we believe that a broader scope, like all business, could prevent the treaty to be really effective, and the text could be more vague or could be not directly linked to transnational operations. So we had a lot of countries, like mainly Egypt and Cameroon, also China. China is not a real ally, but in this matter, China also defends the scope, focus on transnational corporations. And this was something that was changed along the text. And I think it was really important. Of course, we don't know precisely how these changes are going to be incorporated, because this depends on the group of friends of chair. But we are hoping that these proposals can be inserted. And because there were a lot of countries defending this, we think this scope discussion will be an important one to be paying attention in the next years. Also, we had Palestine defending the word violation instead of abuses, or along with abuses, which is really important for us, because it's not a matter only of vocabulary. We need to understand that companies violate human rights. And like Jill said, that they cannot participate in the process since they are the violators. They are the perpetrators. So it's really important for us to understand this role that companies violate, and to use the word violations. It's really important for us. So Palestine proposes that through all the text, and it was really important to get this proposal from countries. And also Palestine also proposed a provision to avoid corporate capture, which is really important for us as well, in Article 15. So we think this would be really valuable to avoid private interests to interfere in the process and in the effectiveness of the treaty. And lastly, and I think the one of the most important additions was the addition of 6.2 bis from Cameroon that foresees direct obligations for companies. And then this is a thing that the global campaign advocates since the beginning. And I think it was really important for us to have a country like Cameroon to propose that and to insert this in the text. Like I said, we don't know how these proposals are going to be inserted by the chair, how this group of friends of the chair is going to work. It's all very blurry right now, but we are hoping that with this concrete participations from these countries and also from the civil society, reinforcing these provisions, that we can recover some red lines for the global campaign in the text.
Thank you very much, Andresa. And I would like now to come back with Breathe and to ask you, particularly Breathe, if you could speak more about the concerns of the global campaign in terms of the future of the negotiations, particularly when we did have this proposal of these Friends of the Chair, this group that's going to proceed to create the new draft of the binding treaty. And there is also a proposal from the European Union to incorporate the business among the actors to be consulted by these Friends of the Chair group. What could you tell us about that, Brit?
Well, indeed, yeah, that is a very big concern that in a way there's a kind of also the process is also not clear, or the criteria on which people will be invited there. And we had some exchanges with some of those who have been really guardians of the treaty. And, you know, like Andresa mentioned there, especially like Palestine, Egypt, Cameroon, Namibia. I mean, these countries have been not only like there in their presence, but they have been extremely well articulated on the demands, no, that's really needed to make this a robust treaty. So we had some exchanges with some of them as to whether they would want to be, they would think about joining the chair. And actually most of them said they are waiting to know what the framework will be and what the procedure will be. So it was very unclear. So, and that still needs to be really clarified. Maybe the second point on that was, you know, we have this phenomenon, as we know, those of us who've been to Geneva for the seven sessions, there's such a phenomenon as Dangerous Fridays, no? This is the last day on which the report of the session is consolidated by the chair, and it's a kind of, it's a state-only session. But this is where the whole proposal about involving the corporations was made by the EU. So, I mean, procedurally, this is problematic, and I think we absolutely have to find a way to block that, or to state again and again that actually the corporations, unfortunately, are represented in the already in a formal way through ICC and IOE, which Erica mentioned. So I think, this is really a major, I think, element of our work going forward. Another one is actually, well, I think maybe based in the European Union and maybe as a citizen here, I really think we have to have very serious discussions in our European networks about how we go forward on the question of how Europe is present and not present. It's doing shadow boxing. It's really time to call a halt to this. On the one hand, they are not there formally, but at the same time, take the privilege of making comments, disruptive comments. It's maybe a few that are not very controversial for them. And I think we need to actually, and we did some initial identification of, we know that within the European Union, it's not a solid bloc on this kind of boycott, no boycott of the talks. No, there are some governments in Europe that are very uncomfortable with this, and the fact that it has gone on for 7 years, I'm saying this is another element of the campaign, especially for the European networks. And I mean, a third element is that to kind of now build on the momentum we have reclaimed, which I really think we have, also because it was very well aligned with the current conjuncture and the role of corporations. And this was reflected very actively in the statements made. We have to really reclaim, we have to build on that momentum and to actually, and I think that was a kind of agreement in our initial assessment and also in the full group call recently, that a main focus will be the work on the ground with governments, I mean, with, of course, movements, but especially targeting the governments that can, and making a much stronger and high profile national debate on this issue of binding regulations for corporations. No, this is where we will win or lose on our red lines, I think. I suppose going forward, I'm kind of seeing three very important elements. One is that we will very much need to interrogate the whole process of the intersessionals and the participation of friends, the creation of the Friends of the Chair. We really need on that. On the second point is in relation to Europe. We have a very strong campaign, I think, ahead of us to call the bluff of the European Union. It's not acceptable that 27 states stay tongue-tied in a very, in a shambles of shadow boxing, no? And then the third point, which is really that we feel very convinced, I think, after our experience in Geneva, that those key areas of the treaty that will make this a robust treaty will really need to get a lot of mileage on the ground with the national governments and with the civil society, engaging their governments and finding a strong way to reflect this to Geneva. That's, I think those were the three main points I wanted to make, Jose.
Thank you very much, Brigitte. And by the way, they were super important because with you speaking now, we are already moving forward in what's coming next. I mean, yes. What the organizations and the social movements need to start doing or to keep doing and doing it even stronger in the, for example, in the national levels. So in that sense, I would like to ask you now, Erika, being in Mozambique, for example, what does it mean, the national work in a country like yours, in a country from the poor world? What does it mean pushing for the binding treaty? How do you do that work? And also, and coming back to the negotiations, some of your comrades from the global campaign have strengthened that the women played a very important role in this last week of negotiations of the treaty. And I would like to ask you, Erika, why? So I am consulting you on those two topics.
Thank you, Jose. Starting with the last point, for sure we have been seeing this really incredible participation from women, from all the regions, from all kinds of groups and social movements. And it's been really amazing to see how that has been happening. At the same time, not so surprising if we really understand the kind of gendered impacts that corporate impunity has and affects and how it affects especially women and peasant women in particular, especially in countries like mine in Mozambique and across Africa and across the global south. At the same time, women are many times at the forefront of these struggles. And in many moments there, we can really see the intersectionality between the struggles against corporate power and corporate impunity and the struggles for women's rights and to dismantle patriarchy. So this is all really connected. And that's, I think this is also why we have been seeing really women taking the forefront of this struggle as well. In terms of the national work, I agree with Brit. This is definitely going to be one of the most important things that we need to focus on. We have been doing that already in the past years. In Mozambique, we know very much the importance of having a treaty like this one. And this is really one of the key arguments that we have been really defending, especially when we are working with government institutions on this issue, which is the fact that this UN binding treaty could really serve as a tool for the affected peoples to access justice and reparation and remedy, but also for governments who have really lost a lot of policy space and a lot of sovereignty in the past few years and decades with neoliberal capitalism and all these pushes for deregulation, all the international arbitration tribunals where companies can really sue states for policies or legislations that these states might be advancing. So this treaty can really be an opportunity to level the playing field and really bring back the decision making to the state and to the people on the ground. So I think this is really important. And we have been working at national level, but also it's very important for us to frame this issue of corporate impunity as something that is not a problem of a specific company or a specific industry or a specific sector or even a specific country, but really is a pattern of behavior that it's really linked to the power that transnational corporations have, the way that they operate. And this is why we can see this reckless behavior and this impunity all across the continent, whether we are talking about agribusiness companies, whether it is fossil fuel companies, whether it is large infrastructure projects. So we can see this trail of crimes and destruction and also impunity due to the inability of our governments and our states to regulate them. So it's been really key to show that this is really an agenda that African states, African movements, affected peoples need to be paying attention to. And we have been doing that in many different levels, in many different constituencies with rural women and rural peasants, with labor unions, with faith-based actors as well, civil society organizations. So it's really interesting to see how the different sectors and the different groupings can bring really important contributions to this process. So to make sure that the context that we have on the ground, what we are seeing in our local struggles when we're trying to bring some of these companies to court, all the obstacles that we are facing, we need to make sure that they help to shape this treaty and the what we will have in the future as this instrument gets adopted. So I think that is really crucial for the way forward.
I just wanted to add maybe to that or say if it's okay, no? I mean, to complement actually what Erica is saying and certainly the work that she and others have been doing in Southern Africa is a very good example of this, that we need this dialectic between the, you know, the affected communities and the articulation of their demands for how a treaty could give them a different life and livelihood with the regional. I mean, it was always very important, for example, when the Africa Group made a statement as a group in the hall, maybe we have to, we are in a good position in a sense in that we have regional networks, you know, where the national work is really well embedded. I mean, also in Asia. And I think, and we'll say also here in Europe. However, I think we need to kind of maybe, well, I mean, that's been done also, but I suppose we're in a mood, you know, where we say, well, what more do we need to do? And I think one of them is also the question of profiling, the question of getting the message out, you know, like in an exchange with one of the governments, for example, and one of the champions of the treaty said, well, you know, the governments have to feel your pressure, have to feel the pressure. Otherwise, you know, it's the voice of corporations and the punitive measures of corporations that really can dominate. So we have ground to make in this regard. And I think people are, yeah, really gearing up for, very active sort of, very proactive campaign. And one of the, I think, lessons we also bring away is we need to start, we are starting on that now, intensify it right through the first 6 months of next year. Because now that we are in negotiations mode, it means people really have to have time and possibility to prepare tasks. I mean, governments. So I think that's one thing our calendar needs to be maybe a bit better aligned with that, even if the fourth draft will come later. I mean, you know, we need to do the groundwork on the key issues that we feel governments have to bring to this discussion. And of course, I think the convergence of the different sectors, you know, as Erica has touched on, is very important. I mean, it is, you know, it's women's organizations and mobilizations. It's the climate activists. It's the health activists. It's the trade unions. It's the social movements. But we need to be more and more coherent in this and make sure that governments have their ears open. to what we are saying.
Thank you very much, Breed, and thank you before to Erica and her important speech about the work needed in the national levels and also in the regions. From Africa, I'd like to jump now to Latin America, having this bridge in the middle passing through Europe with Breed. And I would like to ask you, Andresa, how do you work in the national level in Brazil, in a country where the president is a champion violating human rights, for example, of indigenous peoples in the Amazon forest? So I suppose it's an enormous challenge for the civil society organizations, for the movements, the social organizations, to work pushing for the binding treaty when you are in a country which is ruled by a champion of human rights violations. What can you share with us about that, Andresa? Thank you.
That's true, Jose. Actually, the civil society in Brazil now has her hands full because of the big amount of violations we are seeing from the president and the government in general, because of course there is a large part of the Congress that supports the president as well. But we are trying to engage in a process that is working on a national legislation on business and human rights. We found ground for this because we had like the biggest cases of violations in the last years with Mariana and Brumadinho. And we have found that we have a lot of Congress men and women that are willing to present and to propose a national legislation on human rights and business, like we are calling. And we are working on that. We are still working on the text. We are running against the government, really, because they are trying to present a national action plan, which is a product from the guiding principles, and that we found that besides not working, they are like a way of disengaging in the treaty process, because the country says, I have national action plans, I don't need the treaty, or we have to implement the national action plan first and then to pursue the treaty. So we saw this a lot in the previous negotiations, and we are trying to engage in a national law, a national legislation that will face this national action plan from the government, because we know that everything that comes from Bolsonaro's government is going to be bad. So we are trying to work on this legislation, and hopefully we are going to present, and the Congress men and women are going to protocol this legislation in the next month. So we are very hopeful, and we are trying to win this battle, you know? It's really hard, but we think a national legislation actually helps the process of the treaty, because if the country has a national legislation, it can engage more in the process and say, oh, we have this on our national law, so we can engage this in the process of the treaty, or we can accept this in the text. So we think it's a really important step. But it's hard. We know the context is not it's not in our favor. But we are trying to work with a good text. And then they are going to work politics inside the Congress. And we are hoping that with next year's election, we have a change of scenario, hopefully. And then we can engage more in this national legislation. It's not a short-term battle, but we are working on that right now. I think it's really important. And it's really important to say this is not a due diligence legislation, because this is a trap some countries are falling into, because they are preparing due diligence legislations and due diligence frameworks. But due diligence is not enough. We are hoping for a bigger and broader legislation that could include corporate capture, access to remedy, and other things that due diligence, and to exit from this perspective of self-monitoring that due diligence has. So it's not a due diligence law. We believe that due diligence legislations could be a trap, like the German law, which is really, really bad in our point of view. So we are trying to work on a broader and more complex legislation. It's going to be an uphill battle, but we are trying to engage in this process, and we think this is going to really help the process of the treaty as well.
Jose, I would just like to make one small postscript to this. I think it's obvious maybe from the way in which we're talking about the importance of the national level work and in a number of cases of taking initiative for national legislation. There are maybe two other important actors in this that are actually active already, the parliamentarians and also the cities. In relation to the parliamentarians, I think we have this global interparliamentary network supporting the treaty process, the binding treaty process. And we had one good meeting before Geneva, for example, and a number just on being invited from Brazil and from Argentina came to that meeting. So that's, the national work will really need parliamentarians committed to the treaty to put in place a good national legislation, but also to add their voice to the international parliamentary grouping. So that would be another element, you know, of our strategy going forward. And on the cities, we were able to initiate in the end of 2020 and now also activate in 2021 the question of local authorities, you know, either at city level or local government level or mayor level, because we know that corporations and the violations of, policy, I mean, the violations of human rights and the blocking of progressive policies, even on climate, on energy and so on, is a major challenge for them also, is the operations of corporations. So that's one that we need also to pay more attention to in our strategy of mobilization.
Thank you very much. It was Britt Brennan from the Transnational Institute who is closing now our radio show. She was also in this radio table, let's say, together with Jill McArdle from Friends of the Earth Europe, Erika Mendes from Justiça Ambiental, Friends of the Earth Mozambique, and also representing Friends of the Earth Africa in this show. And also we did have Andresa Suarez from HOMA, the Human Rights and Business Center, which is based in Brazil, in South America. All of you have been more than gentle, super, super helpful to understand this last round of negotiations of the binding treaty on transnational corporations and human rights, and also what might be or could be happening in this next year towards the 8th round of the negotiations, which might take place next year. I really, representing Real World Radio, really feel honored of being with such powerful and strong women, strong activists who have been with us here in this show. So Breed, Erika and Andresa, and we did lose in the process Jill, but also to Jill, of course, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jose.
Thank you very much, Jose.
Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air.